I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Providence, Rhode Island was once the manufacturing center of the nation. The legacy of that history is a magnificent collection of mostly abandoned mills that are slowly being reclaimed for new uses. Clay Rockefeller may not call himself a developer, but is the man behind two exciting mill revivals. His latest is the Steel Yard, and we'll talk to him about it today on Smart City. Also with us is Tom Borup, who, like Clay, has used art to revitalize communities, first as director of Intermedia Arts in Minneapolis, and now as a consultant. We'll talk about how art and artists are remaking cities today on Smart City. But first, the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Clay Rockefeller is proof that innovation happens at intersections, especially at odd intersections like those found where architecture, social commentary, art, and entrepreneurship converge. While pursuing a degree in American civilization and visual art at Brown University in Providence, he teamed up with three fellow artists and launched the Monahasset Mill Project to drive the adaptive reuse of a historic mill complex for subsidized and market-rate artist live-work condominiums. Then he took the property next door and co-founded the Steel Yard, a nonprofit organization that provides arts and technical training programs that increase opportunities for cultural and artistic expression, career-oriented training, and small business incubation. Providence has this amazing collection of old foundries and mills. You now run the Steel Yard in one of them. What first brought the site to your attention?
I had a studio in the abutting building, Monahasset Mill, I think it was 2000. There was a fair amount of development happening in and around the area, fairly kind of straightforward. I'd say it's profit-driven development, kind of looking at the bottom line, and just basically not well thought through. And so essentially it was happening all around us, and we found ourselves in a position to move on the property and try to do something different with it.
Now, describe the site and what you're doing there.
It's a 3-acre site. It was Providence Steel and Iron. It was originally part of Builders Iron Foundry and turned into its own fabrication unit in 1903. And it did predominantly steel fabrication, structural steel, some ornamental ironwork. And it was in full operation up until 2002, I believe. Around 2002, we purchased the site, myself and my partner, actually as a for-profit, somewhat forming an informal land bank to be able to more or less stabilize the site, while we also started a nonprofit that we hoped at the time would grow into a position where it could take on more ownership. We needed to build a lot of track record and collateral programmatically, and so it's over the last 5 years, the nonprofit, which is essentially acted as our anchor tenant while we kind of treaded water and it grew more organically, is an industrial arts center and education facility. So we teach welding, blacksmithing. We have a foundry, ceramics, studios, jewelry, and kind of interact actually with whatever comes our way in terms of folks wanting to share their knowledge base. And for the most part, we try to enable a platform or provide a platform for them to be able to do so.
How do you find yourselves interacting from day to day? Is it just we pass each other going to work and say hello, or is there ever anything more intense or more formal?
We actually sit down and have meetings sometimes, but on a day-to-day basis, I'd say we really interact with each other as there's a variety of ages on the site. There's a variety, everybody seems to come from more or less, obviously a fairly different and distinct background. And I think we all recognize the fact that we have a lot to learn from each other. So on a very basic level, everybody treats each other with I'd say a great deal of respect and interest in terms of where they're coming from and what's going on in their lives. There's also on the site a fair number of professionals. There's an architecture, another informal architectural collaborative, which predominantly focus on green architecture and historic rehab. There's an information architecture and design firm, a couple of other industrial designers, a large-scale sculptor, the Wenasquatucket Watershed Council, who steward the river that runs by the mill. And basically, everybody has something to offer each other. I mean, they're all kind of complementary people, but it's complementary organizations. And so I'd say there's a lot of kind of informal day-to-day business that goes on just simply in passing each other and kind of getting caught up as to what everybody's up to.
Well, obviously, then one challenge is to keep up with the elements as they're evolving. What have been the other challenges in a project like the Steel Yard?
Well, I'd say not having a business background was definitely a significant challenge. I think both my partner and I were blessed to be able to have access to our own resources financially, so that we could withstand, the learning curve, I suppose. And the other challenges are really just trying to kind of, I think one thing in Providence, at least, is it's a fairly historic space. The city, you kind of need to be here for a while in order to kind of get into, I guess, the greater, culture's consciousness as something that's going to be here for a while. And so, new organizations really have to go through kind of they have to stay afloat for a while to kind of prove that they're not just going to fade before I think the community gets really behind them and starts to recognize that they're going to be part of the city's fabric and hopefully continue to contribute in a very positive manner. But the financials, the day-to-day operations have been a real challenge for me just because it's been something completely new on a daily basis. I mean, something so simple as patching leaks in the roof or dealing with broken water lines. I mean, I operate myself on a fairly kind of on the ground, in the dirt level. I mean, one thing that has been the most significant challenge for us has been dealing with some of the environmental issues on the site. The site was contaminated with high levels of lead, and we started working on the remediation of the site about 3 years ago. And so we essentially had to dig up two large piles of highly contaminated soil. One pile got treated and shipped off site to a landfill. The other pile has been treated and stabilized and reinterred. And as of a month ago, we the nonprofit actually got a $400,000 grant from the EPA to help us complete the remediation of the site. But in order to do that, we had to subdivide the site, and we had to essentially transfer two-thirds of ownership. So we subdivided the site into three sections and transferred two-thirds of the ownership, or two of those lots, to the nonprofit actually last Wednesday. So this is kind of what we've been working towards and building up, and all of a sudden there's a lot more shared responsibility. It's spread out, the liability spread out beyond myself and my partner, Nick. And so things continue to move. I'd say, again, one of the probably most significant challenges is patience and learning kind of the virtue of patience and being able to kind of recognize that these things take time.
When you think about that $400,000 from EPA to remediate the site or to complete the remediation of the site, do you think in terms at all, Clay, of working with people in the neighborhood to do that remediation, new groups, community development groups, your own set of people on the site, or is this like, we got the $400,000, there are people who are qualified to do it, let's go hire them?
It's kind of gone back and forth for a while. For when we didn't think that we were going to get the money, there was a lot of talk. I mean, my partner and I bought a Bobcat, and we're pretty, gearing ourselves up mentally to go out and just start digging ourselves. But, there's all sorts of necessary requirements, such as, 40-hour OSHA, licensing and DEM regulations and whatnot. There needs to be a fair amount of communication with the surrounding neighborhood as to what we are doing, and that is required by law for us to, inform abutters and have community meetings and whatnot. But in terms of actual work in getting this process done, I think, I've done some of the, I've been talking to a number of contractors. We're obviously trying to hire local. But when it comes down to it, we are at a point in the site's history where we really just need to get it done and get it done right and be efficient.
And when you think about trying to balance, for instance, historic preservation concerns with sustainability concerns and alternative energy, your alternative energy ambitions, what are those trade-offs?
That's a great question. It's not an easy balance to strike. I mean, the problem that I see really is that historic preservation is a form, obviously, of sustainable architecture and development, as is green innovations and whatnot. I think that there needs to be, I would like to see a more relaxed point of view from potentially the preservationists, or even, I guess, not to, I don't know whether this is the right word, but I guess a little bit more holistic viewpoint and recognizing the fact that we need to be incorporating green technologies such as green roofs or alternative forms of energy harnessing or gray water collection systems into our architecture, as well as I think you can do that and simultaneously be respectful of the historic nature of the buildings. And I think that that's one of the things that I find most interesting about, say, some of the European cities where there have become where I think kind of historic preservation is just almost comes natural to some degree. And maybe that's a naive point of view, but it really just seems like it's something that is just happens in a lot. They're not so quick to just kind of knock something down and put up a big box development. But simultaneously, I was lucky enough to go and visit Copenhagen in Denmark 3 weeks ago. And as I flew in, you basically follow the plane follows a line of windmills, essentially, that are rooted in the ocean, and kind of so you follow this course into this beautiful historic city, but you have these modern technologies essentially highlighted, and kind of the contrast I think is what makes everything beautiful. So I think that we need to work harder and not see things so intensely black and white in between historic preservation as a sustainable form of architecture and development and green and innovations. We need to kind of, I think, make room for both to coexist together.
Providence has so many of these sites similar to the Steel Yard. Many are now being converted to housing and offices. You've converted your site to a center for industrial arts and some complementary office space. Is that the future for the buildings that remain to be revitalized?
I would say, unfortunately, the real estate market is not necessarily pushing things in that direction. I think that the real estate pressures and the market pressures in Providence and Rhode Island definitely kind of, they almost force people to go with a residential mixed use. But residential is the primary component where, people are able to make back their investment. Predominantly because we just don't have the job base here to have and require the various, and also the taxes are fairly challenging as well. But I think that we definitely need to work harder at maintaining and preserving job core buildings where there's room for incubation, there's room for manufacturing. We have, with all the universities around here, we have a huge kind of number of potential entrepreneurs and innovators coming out that just need the space and need the time to be able to, kind of marinate and really, I guess, further develop their ideas and their products.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Clay Rockefeller. He's founder of the Steel Yard in Providence, Rhode Island. To what extent are the industrial arts that you're producing at the Steel Yard part of a larger economy, or is it very boutique-y and local?
I think that that is a good question for our future. I think currently, it's part of a larger economy because it's part of the state economy. The products that, you know, the nonprofit has a fairly strong earned income stream through our urban furniture, which is headed up by Howie Snyder, who is a really phenomenal facilitator, and kind of he's done a great job working with all of the local business districts and the city in creating very unique trash cans, bike racks, information kiosk, for instance, and tree guards. And they're all made by individual artists in and around the area. So it's also kind of, it operates on a number of different levels. It's employing local artists and artisans, as well as it is also contributing because they work closely with the business districts, so the council people and the neighborhood, as to what the final product looks like. It also participates very much in a placemaking, in placemaking and making the area and the space unique, or the neighborhood unique. And then beyond that, we do oftentimes hire out some of the rolling of the steel goes to a local fabricator. Sometimes the powder coating, the sandblasting goes to a local business. And so it is starting to reach out, but we're also still trying to remain local. I think that, you know, we're still very much price competitive with something that the city would otherwise purchase out of a magazine or, you know, a catalog. And the one great thing about it is that the shipping is a lot less. So we're not necessarily getting, 50 trash cans from the Midwest that need to be nothing, obviously, against, hiring out to the Midwest and getting business out there. But, at the same time, at least we don't have, the thousands of miles to have to actually transport these things. And we're also keeping the money local.
And you may not have projected this, Clay, but if you have, I'd like to know the number. What do you think the local market for those placemaking objects might be? Have you thought about the potential? How much is the city actually purchasing?
The city themselves, I think we probably have around upwards near 200 trash cans out on the city streets, most of them being different. Downtown Providence very much wanted something more uniform. It still has kind of the local or the Rhode Island anchors on it, as well as the Steelyard's logo. But they're fairly uniform, there's room for change. They've been extremely supportive. I think the local market, we've been talking to Warren, which is a city outside of obviously Providence, West Warwick, but still, it's all pretty much remained in Rhode Island to date. And I think that is a question that we need to evaluate internally as to, is this a model that we'd like to encourage other individuals in other states and cities to look into for themselves, because it really is about being local. It's about paying, and finding kind of an alternative or creative way to get funding to artists and artisans, when we're actually in a period in which it's quite difficult to find money as an artist, versus kind of, our growth. So I think and we're going to need to take a look at that internally to see whether, which part of this is kind of comes out as a stronger argument in the end for us.
David Cicilline is mayor of Providence. You and I sat down with him a couple of weeks ago on a rooftop overlooking the steel yard. What kind of support do you need from him, from the mayor, to make a project like this one happen and then grow and thrive?
They were really incredibly supportive with the EPA grant. They gave us an extremely positive recommendation letter for the application itself. The easiest answer is, some sort of financial help would be great. But I also understand and very much respect the city's budgetary situation, as well as the state's budget situation, which is, I'd say we are we're going to be facing some challenging fiscal times. We are currently. We just went through our budget review, and I think that probably it. Short of asking for financial assistance, I think basically Mayor Cicilline's been doing a great job in terms of, spreading the word and incorporating us into, some of the things that he talks about when he talks about the positive things happening in Providence, and kind of actually including myself as well as other members who work with the Steelyard in various efforts to kind of gain or look at and brainstorm ideas as to kind of how to continue supporting the arts and the industry of Providence and Rhode Island. So I think there's just a real sense that he respects what we're doing, and that actually goes a long way for us at the moment. It kind of energizes us to keep doing what we're doing. I have to admit to being somewhat of a romantic, and I love myth and I love kind of legend and all sorts of stories. There is something as frustrating as it may be sometimes here. There is something about this city and this state that makes you feel like you can do something differently. I sometimes have fun imagining kind of that Roger Williams, desire to come down and, pursue his own faith, still kind of maintains in the historic fabric and in the cultural fabric of our state. The scale of the city and the state is such that people call you back, which is fairly helpful. And if they don't, you call them back. And if they don't again, you, call them back and they'll eventually get back to you. So I think that accessibility is really a positive thing. I also think that, the fact that you can go out, say, like on a Friday night to a local bar and sit down with a city planner, a community activist, an artist, a neighborhood resident, a developer, and, really kind of engage in some sort of conversation about the future of the city is also fairly, inspiring, I guess. And so that's pretty much what's kept me around, is a sense of possibility as well as a very real level of access and to people that are making fairly significant decisions as to, how the space around us is being approached.
Clay, I'll look forward to my next visit to the Steelyard. Thanks for being our guest on Smart City. Clay Rockefeller is co-founder of the Steelyard in Providence, Rhode Island. You're listening to Smart City. The latest news in the world of urban planning, design, and development comes to us from PlanEdison assistant editor, Nate Berg.
Aging half a century can take its toll on a city. Of the 20 biggest American cities in 1950, 16 have seen their populations decline over the last 57 years. The former glory of these American cities of the post-war age has been drained as the manufacturing economy has steadily trailed off. U.S. Census figures show that many cities, especially those in the Midwest, have lost significant amounts of people since 1950. Cities like Detroit, Cleveland, and St. Louis have lost more than half of their populations in that time. And while once distant areas like Phoenix and Las Vegas have taken over as new population centers, many urban experts say that the older, more established cities will still be able to compete, even with diminished populations. And in a city that embodies the growth-encouraging power of freeways, the days of free driving may be coming to an end. Los Angeles may follow the lead of some other American cities and install congestion pricing and toll road systems on its iconic, cram-packed freeways. The LA Times reports that county officials agreed recently to look into the concept of highway toll roads, a decision that was influenced by the county's painful loss of federal grant money due to the fact that it had no congestion pricing plans. But in a county with one of the largest income gaps between the rich and the poor, many say toll roads will hurt more than they will help. And in other mixed blessing news, car makers in India have announced plans to manufacture new cars that will retail for just $3,000. The Independent reports that the car companies are looking to cash in on the country's growing middle-class population with affordably priced vehicles, including the $3,000 model, which has been dubbed the People's Car. And though the creation of this cheap resource is welcomed by many looking to increase their social status in a rapidly commercializing country, many are worried about how the resulting flood of cars will affect the nation's small, crowded, and severely under-maintained roads. Rickshaws, bicycles, peddlers, and livestock typically fill the space on many of the country's single-lane roads. But with the amount of car registrations increasing by 16% in recent years, and widely expected to increase by even more when the $3,000 models are available next year, Indian roadways are only beginning to live up to the term traffic jam. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor of Planetizen. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Tourism Foundation, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis in the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Tom Borup has been a leader in nonprofit community and cultural work for more than 25 years. His work explores the intersections between culture, community building, and economic development. He served as executive director of Intermedia Arts in Minneapolis, a multidisciplinary cross-cultural organization recognized nationally for its work in nurturing artists and other cultural assets in its diverse urban community. His book, The Creative Community Builder's Handbook, was released last year by Fieldstone Alliance. Tom, you've advised a number of cities on how to use the arts to advance the civic agenda. What do you tell them?
Well, I tell them that they probably have a lot more to work with than they think they do. Usually I begin working with communities by thinking about what their assets are, what their strengths are. Most people lose sight of that. They get so concerned with what they're missing and what their problems are that they forget what good things they do have going on. So we look at those assets and those strengths and those tools that they have to work with and how they can connect people around those tools to address the issues and the challenges that they have in front of them.
Now, when you say tools, to what are you referring?
Well, it usually has to do with their capacity to solve problems, their capacity to work together. And these things are all rooted, in my experience, in the culture of the community, of the people. And, of course, we have many communities that have multiple cultures present at the same time. And we really have to figure out how they can relate, how they have things in common, how they can enjoy and respect the cultures and the ways of doing things. And when I talk about culture, I'm talking very broadly, not just sort of what we think of as the arts, but really the values and the ways of understanding and acting in the world. These are the cultures of people. And unless we address those, unless we figure out how we can work together around our various cultures, we're not going to get very far. So That's a really good place for people to start.
And how do you assess, as a consultant, how do you assess the values and the ways of understanding and acting in the world when you go into a new community?
Well, I love cities. I love communities of all shapes and sizes. And so I like spending a little time to get the feel for those places. And then meeting people who come from the various corners of those communities and finding where the connection points are. And they're often community centers, cultural centers, civic institutions, schools. We all come together around children, and oftentimes we all come together around seniors. We know we need to take care of people at both those ends of life, and that's usually a very common goal that people have. And then bring people together and have some discussion. Usually with food. We all enjoy food, and we all have things to learn about food and how to enjoy it more. And around food and conversation and sharing of maybe music or other kinds of things, that's where people can really explore and let go and start to have serious conversations.
Well, as you point out, when you say culture, you're not simply talking about art and culture. You're thinking about something much broader, and yet you come out of an arts and culture tradition for more than 20 years. You ran Intermedia Arts in Minneapolis. Describe that organization and what you learned there.
Well, that's an organization that actually started many, many years ago using the tools of video as a way to get people out looking around their own communities, looking at themselves and at each other, and having conversations using that medium as a tool to get the conversation started. And back in the 80s, we evolved that work to employ many different artistic disciplines and forms. And we existed in a multicultural, very rich, active South Minneapolis community. And we discovered that all of those people and cultures in the community brought new ideas to the table and new ways of expressing themselves, wonderful, fascinating dimensions of the cultures that they brought. So we were both, at the same time, we were an experimental, kind of a contemporary art experimental organization, and an organization that was, I don't want to say rooted, but very engaged in multiple cultural communities. So it became a ground on which people came together and shared various cultures and ideas. And, of course, a lot of those ideas had to do with the physical community and space in which we all lived and shared together, and how we could work together using this newfound capacity to function across these cultural divides, how we can work together to improve that place that we lived in.
And so how did you improve the place you lived in through Intermedia Arts?
Well, I think we opened a lot of doors so that people could share and communicate with one another, which is a beginning point. And we brought them to the table. We, in fact, used the gallery and theater space of the Art Center to conduct planning charrettes. We brought in community planners and designers and architects to work with the community. We looked at some of the amenities. There was a new bike path on an abandoned rail corridor that cut right through the community, it's something that had been kind of a scar across the community, an abandoned rail corridor, which became a healing place. It became a place of connection between people. And we were very active in bringing people together to figure out how to best take advantage of those new opportunities with that rail corridor. And we looked at a number of other development opportunities that were taking place in the neighborhood and how people could guide them into ways that really serve the entire community and not just one section.
You describe arts and community development in that case of coming together, intersecting by using the arts first to bring people together, then using the space and the sharing that you've done through the art to help plan the community surrounding the place in which art is housed, if you will, or taking place. So is that the principal way in which arts and community development intersect, or are there other ways?
Those are some valuable ways, and I think that's one of the assets we have in many of our communities. But beyond that, one of the things that's just wonderful, and I've been using this in a lot of my work in different parts of the country now, is the skills that artists have. Some artists, not all artists, but there's some artists who have a wonderful ability to connect and engage people's creative thinking. I did a charrette-like program in a small Ohio community just a few weeks ago and brought in a theater artist and a visual artist. The visual artist does a lot of mural kind of work. And we spent 3 days with that community animating the thinking and stimulating the ideas of people to actually visualize and act out in a what they wanted to see. And it was just so refreshing and so illuminating for people to be able to let go that way and really express themselves. These kinds of creative and expressive tools really have a wonderful application to get people expressing themselves, thinking in new ways, and connecting with each other.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Tom Borup. He's a consultant in community and culture, and his latest book is The Creative Community Builder's Handbook, published by Fieldstone Alliance. One of the most powerful examples, Tom, you've seen of the arts being used to advance a civic agenda?
Well, there's a wonderful program that's called Animating Democracy. It's operated by Americans for the Arts. And they've published several books on some of the work they've done. I mean, the list is very long. There was a wonderful project that actually I wrote about in my book that was one of the projects that they were working with in Danville, Vermont. And Danville is a historic small village up in the northern part of Vermont. And the highway department for the state wanted to come through and widen the road. And it really threatened this village and a lot of the historic buildings, just the feel of the community, which I think ultimately was of great importance to people who lived there. And to have cars racing through this what once was a small village was something that some artists were able to come together with some civic leaders and facilitate a creative thinking process, and with the endorsement of the highway department, which was pretty special, and come up with some wonderful ideas to be able to design that road project in a way that the people in the community felt was respectful to their aesthetics, respectful to their way of life, that kept the automobile traffic at a level that they felt was safe. It's just a wonderful way to employ some creative thinking.
I'm wondering what it was about those particular artists that made them particularly adept at leading such a process.
Well, many artists I've worked with who do this they're people. They work
people.
Well
people.
With, yeah, they work well with people. They're just. They often teach. They teach children. There's some artists, and not all again, who just have a special gift for making each person in the room feel creative, making each person feel that they have something special to contribute. And give them tools, and they're non-judgmental. You know, I can't draw, but I'm comfortable now sitting down with some markers or pens and scribbling on paper and then showing it to people and saying, this is what I mean by this scribble here. And then other people are much more gifted in that way. But I think there are artists who just bring that special gift.
Can artists and arts organizations exist but not contribute to community development? In other words, they can be very good at art making, but really not contribute to the larger civic agenda?
Well, that's a complicated question. And obviously there are some who have in some way, some who have kind of shut themselves off and denied that they had any responsibility for anything taking place outside their own walls. And I think that's a falsehood. What's happened in many of those cases is that those institutions have had a negative impact on their community unintentionally, and not through deliberate efforts of their own, but by virtue of their being there, and if they're a significant institution, they do have a big impact on their community, whether they know it or whether they like it or not. So I think it's incumbent on every institution, whatever size, to really look at itself carefully, look at the community around where it's located in, and think about what it is contributing, or sort of de facto contributing, and what it would really like to see, how it would like to contribute, how it would like to shape the community and how the community really talk seriously with the people in their neighborhood and see how they can come together to further the common agenda.
Well, are you saying then you think it's not enough for an arts organization simply, again, to produce great art that then people are, you know, can be inspired by, take it as individuals and run with it on their own versus the arts organization itself becoming a community capacity builder or to get deeply engaged in community building beyond its art?
Well, frankly, no, I don't think it's enough just to produce great art. And not every institution is going to get as involved as I did with Intermedia Arts, for instance. But there's a thing we talk about in terms of corporate citizenship. Whether it's for-profit, non-profit, whatever kind of entity, really has a responsibility to give back in some way. And even though nonprofits are usually spending most of their energy looking at how people give to them as opposed to what they're giving back, it's not a matter of dollars necessarily, but they have to look at how they contribute, how they affect, and how they can modify that effect that they have on their community in positive and constructive ways. So I think there's a corporate citizenship responsibility that all institutions have that goes beyond just the wonderful contributions they make in sharing great art with the community.
So what's the value proposition for the arts organization to get involved in the community beyond making its art?
I think there's just enormous value in contributing. If our institutions are not really examining and being sure that they're contributing significantly to their communities, and they don't deserve to exist. I know that's kind of harsh, but I think the value proposition for them really is that the community will then give back. I was speaking with a group in Wisconsin a few months ago who's restored and is in the process of doing further restoration on a wonderful historic theater building they have in their community. And we were looking at what their assets were, and you know, we made a list, and I said, no, and of course on that list was the building itself. But I said, what happens if tomorrow your building burns down? What do you have left? And it really got down to the relationships that they have. If what they had was gone in terms of their physical structure and their presence and their ability to create their programs, what's going to rebuild it in whatever form is the relationships they have with their community. And those are on the civic, the governmental level, on the individual neighbor level, on the contributor level. If those relationships are strong and they have a great deal of respect in the community, they'll rebuild that structure the next day.
Americans for the Arts just published an updated study on the economic impact of the arts nationally. It measures such things as how much money people spend on purchasing tickets to the arts, how much they spend on dinner and parking when they go to, say, the ballet. How do you think we should be valuing the arts?
Well, I think that's one way. I think that information that shows us that the arts have a significant economic impact and are important pieces of the economy. I think New York City, for one, has recently, and the mayor there has become very clear on the fact that the arts are a major industry that are of great significance to that city. And I think it's true to varying degrees in other places. But that's only part of the equation. And I think that information, that input-output economic analysis is simplistic. I think we also need to figure out how we look at what new wealth is generated within communities as a result of these arts organizations, as opposed to just dollars cycling around. You want to have the dollars continue to cycle in your community as opposed to leave the community. But ultimately, communities have to draw in new resources from outside. They have to have products, services, something that people want, that they'll come there for or purchase and take away or orders over the internet or whatever. So we have to look at that as well. But there's also the social capital value. There's the value of the human relationships and the capacity of the community to work together constructively. If you don't have that, then communities are in trouble. Are just one of the most powerful vehicles to help build that capacity of communities to work together. Now, at the same time, I do want to say that the arts sometimes have and also have the capacity to separate people. And if we get too hung up on this is my art and my art is better than your art, and institutions start behaving that way, you draw divisions in communities, you separate people, you alienate people from one another. I think we have to recognize that communities are rich in cultural assets across the board, and that every person brings some kind of creative gift to the table, and we have to recognize and celebrate that. We can't just build ivory towers that hold, you know, the art. That becomes a problem. So I do want to put that caution out there, but by and large, the arts have a wonderful capacity to build bridges and connections and celebrate all the wonderful creative talents our communities have.
We both attended the recent Americans for the Arts annual meeting in, of all places, Las Vegas. Did you hear anything new or anything of particular interest?
Well, you know, I did hear many people talking more and more about the idea of community assets and the arts as among the community assets. And I'll have to say that in the last few years, that's been that's a conversation I've not heard as frequently. So I was pleased to hear that.
And what did they mean by that, arts as community assets? I mean, where do you take that conversation?
There are many next steps, and that's what I do in my work, is first we learn to identify what the assets are. And that in itself is a creative process. You really have to sometimes be able to see below the surface to understand that something that you previously thought was a deficit or a shortcoming, or you just ignored, was indeed an asset. So first, it's understanding that you do have assets and knowing what they are. And then it's figuring out how to leverage those assets, mm-hmm. how to move them, how to bring them together in a synergistic way that they can move forward to overcome some of the challenges that communities have. Cultural tourism is probably the most simple way to see that, that we see that our communities have something unique and special that we want to share with the rest of the world. And we also know that we have the capacity, Las Vegas is a great example, we have the capacity to accommodate people, to make them feel comfortable, to feed them, to entertain them, to take care of whatever other needs they might have. But at the root of it is that special cultural asset that draws people to that place. And Las Vegas has, in a big way, built on a unique ability that they had, once unique, the gambling. But, you know, Las Vegas has had a lot of competition in recent years, and they've realized that they've had to be able to entertain, amuse, feed people in ways that they didn't 30 years ago.
Tom, I want to thank you for being our guest on Smart City. We should have done this a long time ago, but I'm glad we finally did.
Me too. Great to talk to you, Carol.
Tom Borup is author of the Creative Community Builders Handbook. I'm Carol Coletta. You're listening to Smart City. City View's commentator Walker Smith joins us each week to give us his very personal look at life in cities.
My old-time surefire remedy for a bad day at the office was to stop by the Tower Record Store near my office and buy a stack of CDs. I could listen to one on the drive home and open the others on future plane flights. It was a way to make me feel good about myself again. What the office had taken away, I could buy back. Now, thousands of CDs later, yes, I've had more than my fair share of bad days at the office, I see that my collection was less about music and more about stress. I cluttered up our house with so many CDs that we had to build a special storage room in the basement to get out from under them. There they sit, most of them never played or enjoyed anymore, a testament to the power of shopping in our lives. This is a phenomenon known to researchers. For shopaholics, the act of buying is the thrill, not the fact of owning. It's been compared to crack. You keep coming back for that momentary high. Shopping is an emotional experience, a salve when we need it, and a rush when we want it. It goes beyond physical necessity. We can live without much of what we buy, but we can't live without shopping. In many ways, shopping is not about consuming. It's about leisure. It's one of our national pastimes. We shop because we like to do it, not because we have to do it. We like to look in store windows and stroll around the mall. We like to browse the merchandise to see what's new and interesting. We like to pass an hour just looking, maybe capping it off with a quick buy to get a little buzz before we head home. We consume a lot, but not necessarily because we're greedy. We consume so much because it's integral to our lifestyles. We wind up accumulating far more than we need or have room for. We throw out many perfectly good things that are often picked up, not by the city trash service, but by people cruising neighborhoods looking for things to recycle or resell. And thus do our perfectly good throwaways perform double duty, giving new owners the same thrill from a good find that we got when we bought them originally. Now, many things do have special meaning for us, but our shared obsession with stuff is only occasionally about things per se. More often, it is about the experience of shopping for them. We simply can't and don't care about all of the many, many things we have. We can't even remember all we have tucked away in storage. But we do care about the experience of getting them. This is not to disparage shopping. It is just to recognize it for what it is, and perhaps to suggest that if we understand it more clearly, we can spend our money in more satisfying ways that give us greater value per dollar spent for every sort of exhilaration that matters to us. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders who just released the new report, Kids in Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.